Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, health officials in Arizona are working to get ready to give kids 5 and up their COVID vaccines.
And Phoenix's first ever director of heat response and mitigation on his priorities for the coming months.
But first, former Arizona Attorney General Grant Woods passed away over the weekend. In addition to his role as the state's top prosecutor, he was also a chief of staff to then-Congressman John McCain, among other things. Woods died after suffering a heart attack on Saturday.
He was a political figure that practically everybody knew. He was a Republican until 2018, when he publicly switched his registration to Democrat, but he did remain close with people on both sides of the aisle.
He leaves behind a wife and 5 children and countless friends he has made over the years, many of whom had kind words to say in mourning.
Cindy McCain, the wife of the late Senator John McCain, said, quote, Grant Woods was one of my best friends. My only comfort is knowing he's laughing and joking with John now and watching over all of us.
Mesa Mayor John Giles was one of many public figures who viewed Woods as a mentor. He said, quote, he hired me as a law clerk because, like him, I was a Westwood graduate. He was proud of his Mesa roots. The Mesa Boys and Girls Club bears his name because of his generosity. I'll remember him with great respect and gratitude.
Adrian Fontes, the former Maricopa County recorder who's seeking the Democratic nomination for Secretary of State next year, spoke about his closeness with Woods, who was on his reelection team last year, and encouraged him to run for the chief elections position.
When I got into politics several years ago, he became a mentor to me, and this is a big loss across the board. He was definitely a Renaissance man, and I think that's why he was so authentic. You can't fake a life like Grant Woods.
And with me to talk more about the life and legacy of Grant Woods is Doug Hole with High Ground Public Affairs. He worked both for Woods' friend, John McCain, and political foe, former Governor Fife Symington. And Doug, let's talk big picture here first. How would you describe Grant Woods' political legacy overall?
Well, his political legacy is broad and deep. Grant comes from a longtime Arizona family. His father was Joe Woods, a big developer out of Tempe. Grant really cut his teeth starting as chief of staff for then Congressman John McCain, a little known congressman from the great state of Arizona representing District 1. Grant was a complicated individual. He was bright. He was funny. He had a sharp wit. He loved music and was just a fun guy to be around. But if he didn't agree with something, he took it on head on. And fought what he believed in, and he showed that through his longtime service and friendship with Senator John McCain, and then later in the 1990s as a two-term attorney general.
I want to ask you about some of his work as attorney general, because one of the people that we keep hearing about that he did not get along with and worked, sort of feuding with was then Governor Fife Symington, for whom you worked. What was that relationship like at that time?
Well, you got to first remember that Governor Symington did not come into office until March of 1991. Because in those days, we had a Mecum era law called you needed 50 plus one in order to become governor of Arizona. So there was a runoff election in February of 1991. So Grant had already been in office because he was elected in November and took office in January. Fife Symington won, beat Terry Goddard, and then took office in March of 1991. Things started out okay between the two, but you had two very, very opinionated and charismatic individuals. They both Symington and Woods are very charismatic folks, and the opposite camps started to form early on, and exacerbating not just the personality mark between the two, the attorney general and the governor, both also appointed staff that was also very competitive and very headstrong. So those relationships shaped both the terms of Grant Woods as AG and Fife Symington as governor for two terms.
And that has led to some changes in state law, right? There's some changes that we still have now based on the relationship or maybe lack thereof between those two leaders.
Well, that's correct, Mark, and you're a good Arizona historian. before the two, Governor Symington and Grant Woods took office, historically, the attorney general was the governor's counsel, whether they were friends, whether they were enemies, whether they were from the same party or whether they were from opposite parties. And because of this frayed relationship between Grant and Fife, Fife, along with support from the speaker and the president, got the law changed, which now allows, and every subsequent governor has enjoyed post-Symington, which is Hull, Napolitano, Brewer, and now Ducey, they get to hire their own counsel, general counsel, because of that. And that relationship was the impetus for changing the state law. But I think the biggest conflict, Mark, that happened between the two of them was when in 1994, the legislature decided to create, along with Symington's backing, the Constitutional Defense Council. And it was designed to challenge states' rights issues and federal overreach and initiate lawsuits to assure that the rights of Arizona in the Constitution are upheld by the federal government.
So one of the other things that Grant Woods is obviously known for is his very longtime friendship of John McCain. You referenced it. Woods gave a very moving eulogy at Senator McCain's funeral here in Phoenix. You also worked for Senator McCain. What did that friendship entail, and what did it mean to both of them?
Well, Grant was John McCain's first chief of staff, and staffed his office and his operations here in Arizona, based out of Tempe. And then, Grant and his family, as I stated earlier, were well-known family in the East Valley. And, you know, Grant really started making his name for himself, and the two really complemented each other. They both shared a love of sports. They both had sharp wit, and they both didn't suffer fools kindly, to be honest with you. And they had a very close relationship. That relationship, there were some rocky parts of their relationship over the years, but before Senator John McCain passed, they patched it up. And as we all know, Grant gave him a very moving eulogy at his memorial service. While Fife and Grant really did not get along, John McCain had a close relationship with Fife Symington and Grant Woods. He supported them both. Hmm. And he was kind of the arbiter between the arbiter in many cases between the two of them.
Well, it's interesting because you described both Woods and Symington as, you know, having sort of big personalities and, you know, being kind of headstrong. And I think that's a description that could also fit Senator McCain. It's interesting how it seemed like Grant Woods was maybe unintentionally perhaps drawn to similar people like that and could get along with some and maybe had a difficult time with others.
Oh, yes. And that is exactly the case here. And Grant also liked to surround himself with, very headstrong staff. It's a great loss for the state of Arizona. Grant Woods was a gem and did a lot of wonderful things. And at the end of the day, always did what he thought was right. And, you know, I wish we had more politicians that were in office that just really wanted to try to do the right thing. And that epitomized Grant Woods. And my heart goes out to Marlene and his family.
All right. That is Doug Cole with High Ground. Doug, thanks for your time. Thanks for helping us remember Grant Woods. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Have a great day.
While cases of COVID-19 are going down around the country, they are remaining relatively steady here in Arizona. Over the weekend, Arizona surpassed New York in COVID deaths per capita. And the Washington Post reported the state saw a 138% increase in the 7-day rolling average of new deaths per 100,000 people. This comes as health officials in the state and across the country are preparing for the FDA to issue emergency use authorization for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children as young as 5 years old. With us to talk about what the rollout could look like here in Arizona is Dr. Wasim Balan, a pediatric infectious diseases specialist at Phoenix Children's Hospital. Dr. Balan, good morning.
Good morning, Lauren.
So how is, first of all, Phoenix Children's, how are you preparing for this kind of rollout? This is going to be quite an undertaking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, we're actually very excited that we're finally getting close to getting the vaccine approved for this age group. So we're definitely in communication with the state and the county and making the preparations for when the vaccine becomes available. We already have that infrastructure because we've actually been vaccinating the older children who are eligible. So that shouldn't be a huge undertaking for us at this point.
What does the outreach look like in terms of trying to get kids to come in and get the shot, trying to convince maybe reluctant parents to give it to them?
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly, honestly, it's most of the time based on the face-to-face discussion with those parents and trying to answer those specific questions that each individual family might have related to the vaccine. Again, I mean, we keep encouraging the patients to have those conversations or the families to have those conversations with their pediatricians through the Phoenix Children's Network or, you know, through their pediatricians out of the network. And again, I mean, we understand that the concerns and the questions that some parents have, but we're obviously available to answer any of those questions and discuss with them why it's important to get the children to get vaccinated.
Okay, so let's talk about why and what it is that you tell those parents. I mean, it's been difficult enough to try to convince adults to get vaccinated. Do you hear kind of additional reluctance among adults trying to, when you're talking about very young children?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things that we always get kind of as a comment from the families is that kids do okay with the infection. So why should I vaccinate my child? Mm-hmm. And the answer to this, you know, is actually we start with that, but there are multiple other aspects of why we need to vaccinate the children that we also discuss. So first of all, yeah, it is true that most children, if they get the infection, they actually do okay with it. But that's true for the majority of the kids. Some kids, even you know, some of the kids who didn't have any pre-existing conditions are ending up with severe illness needing to be hospitalized. The other thing that, you know, I'm emphasizing a lot these days because I'm noticing this from my discussion with the families is that when we're talking about pre-existing conditions, people think about that as basically the child who needs to see a lot of specialists and has a lot of, you know, medical care that is needed. But actually, at the top of the list of the pre-existing conditions is obesity, which a lot of times people don't consider as a pre-existing problem. And that's actually what's putting most of the teenagers in the hospital. Most of our sickest patients who came in with COVID-19 are teenagers who are morbidly obese. But when you talk to the family, the impression is that no, it's, you know, the child is previously healthy in their mind. So that's one of the things that I want to emphasize. The other thing is that even though we're saying that most of the children who are ending up with severe illness are usually patients who have medical problems, we've actually, you know, especially during the Delta variant surge lately, we've seen a lot of previously healthy kids who ended up in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So that's the main focus why we're, you know, emphasizing the need for vaccination. The other thing is, you know, that sometimes is something that we don't talk about, but actually families deal with, is that if a child gets sick with COVID-19, whether it's a mild infection or a severe infection, that's going to be time out for, you know, time, you know, off from school for the child. And sometimes that disrupts the family in general in terms of childcare. And, you know, that's also the case if there's an exposure at school. So having the kids vaccinated will definitely decrease those incidents of A, the patient, you know, getting sick and needing to stay out of school for the duration of isolation, mm-hmm. and B, if they had an exposure at school, that they actually might still be able to go if they're vaccinated and protected.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll have to leave it there, Dr. Balan. Yep. That is Dr. Waseem Balan, a pediatric infectious diseases specialist with Phoenix Children's. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll learn why people love to laugh at scary movies.
The characters take the situation so seriously, and I think that breeds for a lot of bizarre moments, a lot of comedy, sometimes intentional, sometimes unintentional.
We'll talk with the creator of the Arizona-filmed Miracle Valley.
But first, a pair of big international conferences are getting underway in the coming days. They are among the top global stories coming up. And with me via Skype for our weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rich Preston. And Rich, let's start with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is meeting for a regional summit. Why is this such a big deal for the international community?
Well, Mark, this meeting is not really about who's going to be there. It's about who's not going to be there. Now, the ASEAN is made up of 10 members: Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. And the one that's not going to be there is Myanmar. Now, a couple of weeks ago, the other 9 members of ASEAN said that a representative of the military junta would not be welcome at the summit. And this really was an unprecedented step for ASEAN. It normally favors a policy of engagement rather than punishment. It doesn't interfere with domestic matters. But foreign ministers from these remaining 9 countries said that this step was necessary and that Myanmar hadn't done enough to restore peace in the country after the military seized control earlier this year. And the reason this is significant for Myanmar is the military leader there, General Min Aung Hlaing, was kind of hoping this summit would be an opportunity to gain some international recognition. Now, there is a bit of a backstory to know about here as well. When Myanmar joined the ASEAN in 1997, it was under military rule at the time. And it was generally considered that bringing Myanmar into the group would put slow, gentle, diplomatic pressure on the military to end their rule and to have peaceful democratic elections. Now that happened. It arguably worked. Myanmar was a success story of the ASEAN. It paved the way for elections, it opened up foreign investment, and everything was ticking along nicely until that military takeover earlier this year. Those widespread arrests, those killings of protesters. This has once again put the pressure back on ASEAN as to how it acts and reacts when it comes to Myanmar. And most of the countries in the world think ASEAN is the only way forward. They look at ASEAN as being pretty much the single solution as to how to resolve the problem in Myanmar. So we're going to have to wait and see how these talks go on Wednesday, with Myanmar not invited, but definitely high on the agenda.
Interesting. All right, Rich, from Southeast Asia now to Africa. Tomorrow, a draft bill is being debated in Parliament in Ghana under the guise of family values, but which many say will introduce some of the harshest anti-LGBTQ laws in Africa. What is happening there?
Yeah, and this is no understatement, Mark. Let me walk you through this. The bill is called the Promotion of Proper Human Sexual Rights and Ghanaian Family Values Bill, so bit of a mouthful. If it's passed in its current form, it could see LGBT Ghanaians sent to jail or forced to undergo conversion therapy, which of course has been widely debunked by the international medical and psychiatric communities. But the bill goes further than just these individuals themselves. Advocates of LGBT communities could face up to a decade in prison. Friends, colleagues, neighbors, anyone who supports an LGBT individual could face prison time themselves. Certain types of medical support, such as hormone therapies, would be made illegal. Distribution of material deemed pro-LGBT by news organizations would also be illegal. Mark, if you and I were having this conversation on Ghanaian radio, we would be facing jail time.
Wow.
And it goes one step further than that as well. It calls on Ghanaians to inform on those they suspect of being LGBT, picking up the phone, calling the police and reporting your neighbor for being lesbian, gay, bisexual or transgender. Now, homosexuality is currently illegal in Ghana. The thing is, it's rarely implemented. And if it is, it varies in different parts of the country as to how the law is interpreted and applied. So the people pushing through this bill say that this is about bringing everything together and having one rule for the entire country. Now, LGBT people in Ghana do already receive harassment, abuse, and intimidation, but the people behind this bill say this is about family values. They call themselves moral warriors. Now, Ghana generally portrays itself as being young, vibrant, forward-thinking, progressive, and this, of course, raises serious questions over that image. It has been called a homophobe's dream, and that's being debated tomorrow.
All right. And finally, Rich, on Sunday, COP26 gets underway in Glasgow. And the news coverage, of course, has been building up about this. But what exactly is COP26 and what are we looking to get out of it?
Well, Mark, the easiest way to describe COP26 is It's the sequel to the Paris Climate Conference of 2015. That was COP21. That was where all world leaders gathered together and agreed to implement measures to reduce global warming. Now, the agreement was that global warming would be limited to well under 2 degrees, but with an aim of no more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial averages. Now, COP21 in Paris in 2015 was seen as huge and significant. The United Nations has been running these events for 30 years, these COP events, Conference of the Parties it stands for. And one of the agreements in Paris was that they would, countries would get together and renew and review their promises every 5 years. So COP26 is the first time that's happened since the agreement of Paris 2015. Now, under the Paris Agreement, every country committed to making these national plans as to how they would reduce their emissions. These are known as nationally determined contributions, or NDCs. Now, remember that, because you are going to be hearing a lot about NDCs over the coming week. That's every country's individual plan. So COP26 is all about renewing these plans. And that's in part because the plans made in Paris didn't go far enough. Most scientists say that more needs to be done. So COP26 is seen as being decisive in being harder, firmer, and more drastic on that front. Now, there are three goals that you want to watch out for with COP26. One is those NDCs. The second goal is finalizing what's called the Paris Rulebook. Now, those are the rules that countries will stick to in order to achieve the goals they set out in Paris. And the third one, and a major one, is funding. One of the contentious issues during the Paris negotiations was between the developed and developing world. And that's because of the anomaly that the developed world is the one that generally spews out most fossil fuels, but the countries that are impacted by global warming tend to be the developing world, which are the countries that can't afford to as quickly replace their energy supplies or deal with the effects of climate change, such as extreme weather. And in Paris, there was lots of pressure on the developed world to stump up the cash to help the developing world. And there was an agreement that $100 billion would be raised every year to finance climate support for the developing countries. So in Glasgow, they want a reassurance on that commitment and, if possible, a promise of more money. Events get underway on Sunday.
All right. Lots to watch for, as always. That is the BBC's Rich Preston in London. Rich, good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, Mark. Thanks.
Last week, the Biden administration announced it would reinstate the so-called Remain in Mexico program, a Trump-era program that sent migrants back to Mexico to await their immigration court proceedings. It made the move after a judge ordered it, but the Department of Homeland Security said it disagrees with that decision. At the same time, though, the Biden administration has kept in place another program that allows for something similar, called Title 42. The program was also put in place by the Trump administration as a public health measure to protect from the spread of COVID-19. And it's meant that tens of thousands of asylum seekers have been quickly returned across the border before pleading their cases. Immigration advocates have called that program inhumane, and now a new report sheds light on why. Human Rights First painstakingly documented abuses against migrants returned to border towns as a result of the protocol. And I spoke with co-author Kenji Kinzuka more about it.
So Human Rights First has been researching the Title 42 policy and its effects on asylum seekers since March 2020, when the Trump administration first put it in place. And over the past, you know, now year and a half, we've conducted hundreds of interviews with asylum seekers, with attorneys representing people trying to seek asylum, with humanitarian aid workers. And we also look at data. So we look at government data, we look at surveys that are conducted of asylum seekers, we look at legal complaints that have been filed around Title 42. And from those sources, we're able to draw, you know, examples of the kinds of harms and the kinds of danger that people are facing because of the policy.
So tell me a little bit about some of those stories that you hear, some of these interviews that you conducted. What kinds of things are migrants facing?
One of the most frequent harms or dangers that we hear from asylum seekers who are expelled to Mexico after trying to seek asylum in the U.S., whether that's at a port of entry or after crossing the border, is that they are at risk of kidnapping. So people who are turned back to Nuevo Laredo, to Reynosa, to Tijuana, to Ciudad Juarez, all across the border have told us that sometimes in the minutes or, you know, just moments after being returned, they're kidnapped. Or they go to one of these informal tent encampments to stay, and there they're kidnapped. Or they're kidnapped while crossing the street trying to buy food for their family or to go to a pharmacy to buy medicine for their children. It's just so dangerous, and it's so obvious that they are vulnerable migrants who have nowhere to go. And that happens because they're expelled back to these dangerous border cities, sometimes in the middle of the night, frankly, and that puts them at really extreme risk.
Describe the sort of systems in place here. I mean, like, who's doing the kidnapping? What's the purpose of that?
The kidnappings are often carried out by the cartels that control areas of the border where asylum seekers and other migrants are trying to cross, as well as the cities where they're being returned to. And unfortunately, Mexican officials, migration officials, police, National Guard are sometimes complicit in or even themselves carrying out those kidnappings. So asylum seekers frequently tell us that they don't feel safe going to the police to report these incidents because sometimes the police themselves are involved.
So in this, you come up with this number. You report that at least 7,647 kidnappings and other attacks on people who are blocked or expelled under Title 42 have taken place. How do you come to a number like that?
So that's a number we've been tracking since January 2021, when President Biden took office. And we've come up with that number by looking at the number of people who reported being kidnapped, raped, assaulted, in surveys that have been conducted with asylum seekers who are stuck in Mexico or expelled to Mexico, as well as our own interviews. We've done hundreds of interviews over the past year, and from media reports, from legal complaints that are filed, from other published sources. And so from all of those, we're able to compile this number that tracks the at least reported cases of harm. But we know that there are far, far more people who've been injured, attacked, who are missing because of this policy.
Mm-hmm. The Biden administration also has announced recently additional plans to restart the so-called migrant protection protocols known as Remain in Mexico Often, which is a similar policy that would do something very similar to what Title 42 has been doing all along here. What are your concerns given now there's more than one program that could be returning people relatively quickly to these border towns?
We have essentially identical concerns with the Remain in Mexico program. We also researched that policy when it was in effect under the Trump administration, and we tracked, again, over 1,500 cases of kidnappings and other violent attacks against asylum seekers who were returned to Mexico under the Remain in Mexico program. So whether the Biden administration is expelling people under Title 42 or returning them to Mexico under the Remain in Mexico program, people will face the same dangers, the same risk of being kidnapped, of being raped, of being assaulted.
The Biden administration, though, Kenji, has defended this rule, not the migrant protection protocols, but Title 42, arguing that it's, a public health measure that's protecting against the spread of COVID-19, keeping this in check in these regions. What do public health experts that you have talked to have to say about this?
For the past year and a half, we've worked with many public health experts who have provided recommendations to the Trump administration and then to the Biden administration about how to process asylum seekers at the border safely using protocols like social distancing, masking, and then, of course, when it became available, COVID testing. And they over and over again told the Centers for Disease Control, Health and Human Services, the Department of Homeland Security, that this could be done safely. And those recommendations were ignored.
Another argument made here, though, has to do with sort of the systems in place in this country. I've heard arguments made that we just don't have the infrastructure in our asylum system to deal with this. So the Biden administration, only has so many tools in its toolbox to address this with so many asylum seekers coming to the border, and this is one of them, so they've kept it in place. What do you think needs to happen? Like, if this rule is lifted and we have this many asylum seekers allowed into the country, how would we address it?
It's interesting. This past month in September, the administration found the capacity to carry out over 70 expulsion flights carrying 8,000 Haitian migrants and asylum seekers back to Haiti, which is an incredibly dangerous place at the moment. They were able to do that finding the resources, finding the personnel, finding the capacity to carry out those expulsions. And so it seems disingenuous for the administration, especially now, 9 months after taking office, to say that they don't have the capacity to process asylum seekers when they can find the capacity to expel them.
Kenji Kizuka is an associate director for research and analysis at Human Rights First, co-author of this report, joining us to talk more about Title 42. Kenji, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Phoenix has become the first city in the country to open a publicly funded Office of Heat Response and Mitigation. That's part of nearly $3 million to deal with heat and climate change in the most recent city budget. Miami, Florida now also has a similar office, but its is privately funded. Phoenix recently named the new and first ever director of that office, ASU climate and health scientist David Hondula. He started with the city earlier this month, and when I spoke with him, I asked how he plans to prioritize where he puts his office's efforts and resources, at least at first.
Thanks, Mark, for the opportunity to chat. And you're right, there is a big challenge ahead for the heat office in the city of Phoenix, and indeed for all cities across the United States, where heat has historically fallen through our governance gaps. It's not clearly a hazard that's the responsibility of emergency management. It's not clearly the responsibility of human services or sustainability. And while we know that a lot of folks in city government, both here in Phoenix and elsewhere, are really concerned about some of the challenges associated with heat and making cities cooler, it hasn't until very recently been the entirety of their jobs to do so. To speak to your question about priorities, first and foremost, the office is intended to have a dual and equal focus on heat response, which we think of as strategies to protect people and keep them safe when it is hot, and heat mitigation, which are largely longer term strategies to cool the city and make it safer.
So when you look at the issue of heat response, heat mitigation, are you focusing more on trying to do things that will stop things from getting worse here? Are you looking at trying to do things that will maybe ultimately cool this city off and make things better here? Like, how do you try to determine which is the most efficient way to approach this?
Yeah, well, we're absolutely trying to split our thinking 50-50 between protecting people from heat emergencies as they happen here every year. 191 heat-related deaths just in the city of Phoenix in 2020. The numbers are still being tabulated for 2021, but of course we'll be looking at those closely. But getting people into shelter, putting a water bottle in their hands, putting a umbrella in their hands for shade while they wait for a bus, 50% of our time on those types of programs, and 50% of the time thinking about those longer-term cooling strategies that you mentioned. We'll be working very closely with ASU and other partners that can help us evaluate our work. A great example is the Cool Pavement Pilot Program that's been widely documented in our region. So we will be absolutely relying a lot on evaluation, more pilot scale projects, and when we're ready to go, not hesitating to ask for resources to scale them up.
So you mentioned working with ASU, and that is, of course, where you have worked for a while, doing this kind of research for several years now. Where is the technology in terms of things like cool pavement or, you know, other kinds of things that might be coming, that might be being developed right now that can help you in this effort?
Yeah, there are some really exciting technology developments that we are excited to continue to explore and experiment with. You know, in terms of heat response and even heat mitigation, not every strategy has to be high tech. Putting a water bottle in somebody's hand can make a difference. Putting a tree in the ground, that can make a difference. So we can't be ignoring low or no tech solutions that we think can be a really important part of the heat solution portfolio. But technology continues to develop by the minute. There's been a really exciting pilot project in our neighbors to the east, Tempe, looking at a particularly reflective film on the roof of bus stops that not only reflects more sunlight out into the environment, but actually makes the, you know, it appears that it makes the environment under the canopy cooler than it otherwise would have been. So we're getting benefits above and beyond reflectivity. I think we see, especially with the increasing narrative and attention to heat in the national media, I think we're going to see the market respond to that and continue to develop products, technology, services that we need to be looking at closely.
I want to ask you about the issue of shade and trees. And the city has been talking about trying to increase its tree canopy and its overall the amount of shade that is in the city. I know you are new into this office, but from what you've been able to glean so far, why is it proving to be so challenging for the city to get more trees in the ground and to really increase the amount of shade that it has that can cool things off?
Yeah, I think part of our job in the new office is to acknowledge and transparently communicate the point you just raised, that it has been very hard for our city and indeed many other cities to make progress on tree and shade goals. 2010 was a really difficult time for cities to make any sort of investments. But I think some of the shortcomings that are reflected in the city's current climate and heat readiness investment in the budget were also factors. Didn't have adequate personnel with sufficiently broad reach and authority to coordinate programs across city government. And we really didn't have much in the way of resources allocated to get more trees in the ground. And that is a deficiency that the current budget works to overcome. The commitment for at least 1,800 trees per year as part of the Cool Corridors initiative, which will really prioritize some of our most underserved areas.
Are you optimistic that by the time the heat rolls around again, you know, next spring or so, that you will have some of these things in place that will make the city more ready to deal with the heat of 2022 than it has been in years past, even if it's not some of the longer term things you're talking about, maybe just things as simple as having more water bottles and cooling towels for folks?
The answer to that question has to be yes. And if the answer is not yes, we've failed as an office in our first, what I would say is 5.5 months here looking at the calendar. I think April 1st, we need to be ready to go. The first heat-related death in Maricopa County last year was recorded on April 11th. April 11th, 2 months before the start of summer proper.
Yeah.
So we need to be ready to go by early April. And I think ready to go means more trees in the ground, which we know we're going to be able to do through that Cool Corridors investment. I think it means having some more of those resources available that you talked about, water bottles, cooling towels. Of course, that can't be the entirety of our solution to solve our heat challenges, but I think we do need to be ready to go with some of those tangible products. And I think we can do so. I'm encouraged by some of the conversations we're having already. And I think it also means that our programs operate, as we talked about earlier, in a more connected, synergistic, coordinated way. And that's progress that it may not be as visible in a first year to the community, that it's inside City Hall. We are more coordinated in terms of how we're operating cooling centers, for example. That coordination, I think, will take a little bit of time to manifest itself in terms of what people can see in particular with respect to services that are provided at cooling centers. But we need to see progress on that coordination mechanism as well. And we're already starting those conversations in our first 2 weeks of existence.
All right. That is Dave Hondula, Director of the Office of Heat Response and Mitigation with the City of Phoenix. Dave, nice to talk to you. Thank you. And good luck.
Thanks. Thanks, Mark. And we absolutely welcome input from the public as we move forward.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. For this morning's conversation, our co-host Steve Goldstein and Phil Boas of the Republic stepped outside of Arizona and the Southwest to talk about the extended impact of the U.S. war in Iraq. The discussion was prompted by the recent death of General Colin Powell, the former Secretary of State. They began by talking about Powell being remembered by many for his advocacy of the invasion of Iraq, what some called the worst mistake of his career.
That was what stood out to me, was a man who had accomplished so much in his life, who had risen to, you know, the highest tiers of power, you know, Secretary of State, America's face to the world, the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, all these important positions in the U.S. government, was being framed right after death for the greatest mistake that he ever made, and that was for making the case, and especially making it before the Security Council of the United Nations, that the United States and its allies should go to war, invade Iraq. And so it became a large part of the obituary, maybe the most defining part of the obituary, that Powell was one of the principal actors who took America to a war that it probably never should have fought.
What's interesting about the column is that you put yourself in the middle of it and talk about being on the wrong side of history yourself and the arguments you used to have with the editorial board. Go into more detail on that. I thought that was pretty fascinating, sort of looking back at your own perspective on it.
Well, I wanted to make a point about just about our own judgment and how we deal with facts as they emerge, because we were engaged in the same debate. And of course, we weren't going to be as consequential to it on the editorial board of the Arizona Republic, but we had members of the board that were debating the Iraq war and whether we should invade Iraq. I was basing my arguments on the same things that Colin Powell was basing his on, and that namely that 9/11 represented America's inability to imagine that it had shadow enemies that could strike with devastating force. And we had no idea. We had no idea that that we had terrorist training in our country to fly airplanes into buildings. It was happening. There were little inklings of it when you go back and look back, but we really didn't know at the time. We couldn't see it or hear it through all the noise, and the intelligence was terrible on 9/11. And we took that intelligence, after that huge intelligence failure, we went and we used this human intelligence, the espionage, to create the basis for an invasion of Iraq that was now, as we look back, was ill-founded. It was based on flimsy evidence, evidence that was flatly wrong, because Saddam was not the threat we believed him to be.
Did the U.S., did people in charge actually learn lessons from that? And if so, what kind of lessons should they have learned?
There are a couple of big lessons that I learned from it. And I think you hope that the U.S. government has learned. No doubt there's less faith in intelligence, in the secret services of the nation and other nations. It wasn't just the American CIA that was telling us that Saddam had WMD. Virtually all the intelligence agencies of the major nations, France, Britain, Israel, the Mossad, were all confirming that Saddam had WMD and making the case that it was there. The United Nations believed he had it and was hiding it. The Russians believed it. You know, and we were all feeding each other, you know, and giving each other confidence in what was ultimately flimsy evidence. The important thing that I wanted to get across is that I was wrong about that. And as the evidence emerged that Saddam didn't have WMD, that I had to come to the grips of the fact that I had been wrong in arguing for the war. And I was pointing to one of my colleagues, Kathleen Ingley, who at the time was making the case against war and was just spot on in her criticism. And her criticism was that we have virtually no understanding of the Middle East, of the sectarian struggles and battles that are going on there, and that we're going to be caught in another quagmire if we go over there and try to manage all that. And she was absolutely right. That became the huge problem. It wasn't the invasion, which went pretty smoothly and pretty quickly, but it was, you know, trying to nation build afterwards, that it was just became an impossible task and one that we couldn't manage. And so I had to admit, you know, that I was wrong. But I think that's an important point. When all the evidence points to the fact that you're wrong, you need to adjust to it. You need to adjust your thinking to it, because ultimately the quest is for truth. What is real? What is true? And so very often that means you have to reckon with your own mistakes. And I've had to do that since.
Well, that takes me back, Phil, to close to what you were talking about, having those intense discussions with the editorial board. But as you said, that was at a much lower level than the intense discussions that were happening at the highest levels of government. The fact that you're able to look back and say that you were wrong, do we get enough of that from people at the top?
Well, Colin Powell did. I mean, he did come clean about it. And he talked in the years after about how much it pained him to have been the one who made that case, because you're exactly right that what he was doing was much more consequential than what we were doing. We were Americans having a debate, which we needed to have, and we needed people for and against it to fully ride out the, you know, all the issues and to discuss them and whatnot. And so I have no shame in acknowledging or admitting that I was wrong. You have to have these debates in our country.
Phil Boas of the Arizona Republic. Phil, thanks as always. Take care.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Steve.
In 1958, a fire and brimstone preacher named Asa Alonzo Allen bought 2,400 acres of barren desert deep in the southeast corner of Arizona. He called the tract of land Miracle Valley and built up a massive church community there. After his death, the church passed through various owners. By the 80s, it was a full-blown cult. The community bottomed out after a 1982 shootout with local and state police that ended with 9 people dead. Today, Miracle Valley is a half square mile of desert and home to 644 residents and an abandoned Bible college. It is also the inspiration of a new horror film, appropriately called Miracle Valley. The writer, director, and star of the film is Greg Sestero, whose credits include Gattaca, EdTV, and the recent Netflix hit The Haunting of Bly Manor. But Sestero is most well-known for his role as Mark in The Room, the 2003 independent drama that is affectionately known as the best worst movie of all time.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hey, Johnny. What's up?
I have a problem with Lisa. She said that I hit her.
What? Well, did you?
No, it's not true. Don't even ask. What's new with you?
The film and its star, Tommy Wiseau, have carved out a significant space in pop culture reserved for celebrating camp, a space held by the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Plan 9 from Outer Space. Cicero's 2013 book, The Disaster Artist, chronicles the wacky hijinks experienced on the set of The Room. It was later adapted into a film starring James Franco. I spoke with Cicero more about his new film recently and what brought him to Arizona to make it.
I've always been intrigued by cults, and I've always loved 70s horror. And I got a taste of filming in Arizona back in like 2017. We filmed in Tucson, we filmed in Patagonia. And I thought it'd be a great chance to come down to Arizona, get away from the world, you know, live there on an isolated ranch, write a script in that environment,
yeah,
and then proceed to film in that environment. So I would take road trips around Arizona. I went to Lake Powell, Antelope Canyon. I did Bisbee, and I stumbled across this old church alongside the highway. And I walked up to it, and it was this beautiful church that was hollow on the inside. And I was approached by a few people who told me the background of the story of Miracle Valley. You know, they said that this was a cult in the 60s and 70s, and there was some incidents that had occurred. And so I was really fascinated to come across this story. And so I then went and studied Terror in the Jungle, the Manson cult, you know, a little bit of what Scientology's origins were. And I decided I was going to write this story and tie it into these amazing places that I'd come across.
Hmm. So in the course of that, I mean, you dig way into horror references in this film. What, first of all, drew you into horror, into that as a genre?
So one of the first movies that I saw that shocked me as a kid was Nightmare on Elm Street. And so I was always fascinated by the horror genre because it's the one type of film that you can make people laugh. You can throw in drama, you can mix in a lot of emotions that also works great with an audience. I loved Hitchcock, Psycho, The Thing, the original Halloween. I just love the idea of mixing those genres together, and horror was a great opportunity to move on from, you know, having written The Disaster Artist, mm-hmm. having survived the cult movie The Room. I thought it was a great chance to go in that direction.
I wanted to ask you about The Room, of course. I mean, this is something that will always follow you, but also that you've turned into something really amazing with The Disaster Artist. I mean, is it weird that this is something that you know, everyone's going to recognize you as Mark for the rest of your career? Or is this something that you're welcoming at this point?
I mean, The Room has been going for 20 years. And I think if a film is able to do that, regardless of how bad it is, which it is, I think that's pretty amazing. And I think it must have something special. And I think for me, it's about embracing that and then taking, you know, the lovely people who have followed me and supported me through these years and give them, you know, new and original films. And I think hopefully the Ojais will branch off into new characters.
In doing that, I mean, you are casting yourself in this, you're directing it, you're writing it. This is very much your baby. Does that put a lot of pressure on this in your mind?
I don't, you know, at this point, I don't really feel pressure. I think I felt pressure with the Disaster Artist book because I was telling a story behind the making of a movie that a lot of people loved. And I was putting myself out there. And really, I wanted that book to be turned into a good film. And all those things happened. And so now going forward, I'm just looking to make original content and put, you know, everything I have into new movies and giving the audience a new journey. And I think I'm more about having fun at this point than concerned about, you know, about pressure.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of references that you're making in this film in terms of the approach, not just the writing, but like the way it's filmed and the kind of horror camp that you're trying to dig into here.
I think, you know, it goes back to watching a lot of 70s horror. You know, one of my big influences was a movie called Jewel by Steven Spielberg. And it just takes these, you know, familiar human situations, a bit crazy, over the top, but the characters take the situation so seriously. And I think that breeds for a lot of bizarre moments, a lot of comedy, sometimes intentional, sometimes unintentional. And I love the idea of shooting on film, handheld, and really giving the audience sort of an uneasy look into these characters' lives. And I think that's sort of what we tried to approach it as.
And lastly, I just want to ask you, Greg, about, you know, your lasting impressions of Arizona here. It sounds like you really saw the state in its breadth and you filmed this project here that's close to your heart. You know, what do you think of our state here and what would you like to do here in the future? Anything?
I mean, I've made two films now in Arizona, and I feel like, you know, we were pretty expansive with Miracle Valley. I mean, we got in Bisbee, Tucson, Lake Powell, Sedona, you know, some highway stuff in Phoenix. So something about the culture and the lighting, the landscape, it immediately sets a tone and a mood that you can't really write for. It just, you have such an advantage being in that environment. It's away from Hollywood. It's away from, you know, that fabrication. So it gives you a real setting for an audience to be excited to step into and almost give them like a mini vacation to come into this world.
All right. Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That was my conversation with the writer, director, and star of the new film Miracle Valley, Greg Sestero. He'll be presenting Miracle Valley at the Majestic in Gilbert tonight, in Tempe tomorrow, and at the Loft in Tucson on Wednesday. And that's it for today's edition of the show. We thank you for joining us. Have a good one.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody for Lauren Gilger and Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening today.